You gotta be kidding me. Math is racist? Grammar is racist?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, we're going to have an awesome broadcast today, eye-opening as well as edifying. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. All right, I expose error because I love truth. I will give warnings not to be controversial, not so people will say, oh, you told us so, but because I get concerned about issues in the world around us and want to sound the alarm. And friends, in contrast with many, many other talk radio shows that are primarily politically based or ideologically based or sociologically based, we are primarily biblically based. And everything we do flows out of Scripture, flows out of putting Jesus first. And then from there, we talk about relevant issues of the day. So we're going to get into this discussion about grammar and math being called racist. Yeah. Have you ever heard of feminist geography, by the way? A related subject. We'll talk about that. Then the bottom of the hour, I'm going to bring on my guest, Tom Gilson. He has an amazing new book about the character of Jesus, Too Good to Be False. So we're going to have an interesting, edifying talk with Tom starting at the bottom of the hour. All right. I have been, like a brokered record, shouting out that the BLM movement is not really about black lives, that the BLM movement is not something that you, as followers of Jesus and lovers of the word, want to be part of, that we stand together in proclaiming that black lives do matter. We stand together in exposing racism where it exists, injustice where it exists. We stand together as a body, as a family, in dealing with those things. At the same time, we see what's behind much of the BLM movement. We see where it's going. We see the spirit of anarchy and lawlessness. We see the other groups like Antifa and these others coming in with their own lawlessness and rioting and looting and vandalizing. And at the beginning, there were people trying to justify some of the looting and vandalizing and say, look, there's a built-up frustration and pain and it's bursting. I understand. But when you're breaking into some, Target store and carrying out a big screen TV, that's not because of George Floyd. Okay, that's looting, that's vandalism, that's lawlessness, that's greed. Well, Chicago ravaged now with destruction, police injured, and some of these police, police chiefs are black, by the way, all right? They're taking their lives in their hands to stop the looting and the vandalizing. Millions of dollars in damage. Well, listen to this. This is BLM leader Ariel Atkins, NBC News. Listen to what she has to say about the looting that just took place.
I don't care if somebody decides to loot a Gucci or a Macy's or a Nike, because that makes sure that that person eats. That makes sure that that person has clothes. That is reparations. Anything they want to take, take it, because these businesses have insurance.
This is the social madness. This is the spirit of lawlessness and anarchy that we have been addressing. This is a local BLM leader. Let me urge you again, separate from that movement and let the body of Christ come together and let other people of conscience come together and let us address issues where they need to be addressed. And when it's not a matter of systemic racism, but just a history of things that we're trying to fix where things are wrong, or school issues or education issues, and how can we address them together? Let's address them together, but separate from this garbage. Now, I want to contrast that voice of that woman with several black voices, all black leaders, all respected in their communities, some strongly liberal Democrats, could be all of them for all I know, but at least two strong liberal Democrats. Let's first listen to the Chicago superintendent of police, Superintendent Brown, no relationship. Listen to what he has to say about the looting, the vandalism that took place.
Friday through Sunday, 6 p.m. to 11:59, there were 31 shootings throughout the city, three of which were murders. These shooting incidents and the looting we saw overnight are completely unacceptable. Criminals took to the streets with confidence that there would be no consequences for their actions. And I, for one, refuse to allow these cowardly acts to hold our city hostage.
Yeah, that is a black police superintendent. That is a black voice. That is a black life calling this what it is. Elsewhere, he said it is pure criminality. Then you got some BLM leader saying, go ahead and loot. Go ahead. This way you got something to eat. Oh, yeah, right. Sure. And you're looting because you want something to eat. I guess you're going to then take the stuff and sell it on the street for food. Right. Sure. That's why you're getting Gucci. Of course. Obviously. Stealing from a store like that. And they got insurance. What kind of madness is being cultivated and encouraged? Here you have a black police chief superintendent saying, not on our watch. This is criminality. What about the Democratic mayor of Chicago, Mayor Lightfoot, another black voice? What does she have to say about the looting and the vandalism?
These individuals' engagement can only be described as brazen and extensive criminal looting and destruction. And to be clear, this had nothing to do with legitimate, protected First Amendment expression. To those who engaged in this criminal behavior, let's be clear. We are coming for you.
Oh, yeah. Criminal behavior. Criminal behavior. We are coming for you. Go ahead and loot. Take what you want. You need to eat. It's reparations. It's not reparations. This has nothing to do with reparations. There's nothing righteous, good, godly, honest, just about any of that. Zero. So, of course, the black superintendent of police, the black mayor, are speaking truth in this situation. And these are also black lives and also black voices. Here's a conversation from Detroit. This is on Fox News. And this is Detroit Police Chief Craig, who's also black. I'm identifying these individuals as black so that no one could possibly throw this into a narrative of some type of white supremacy against the poor black looters. No, and look, in city after city, plenty of the vandalism is done by white thugs. It's got nothing to do with black lives. It's got nothing to do with justice whatsoever. And now the police chief of Seattle, is not that a black woman? She's resigned because of the defunding of the police and the cutting back on job powers. Oh, yeah. And what's that going to lead to? Blacks getting killed and people in the inner city getting killed and poor people getting killed and gangs running rampant. This is why we have been shouting for weeks and weeks and weeks, separate from the spirit of the BLM movement, separate from what is happening and what they are pushing, and let us work together to address real issues that are there. Listen to what Police Chief Craig had to say.
One of the things that we saw here in Detroit, almost eerily similar to what happened last night in Chicago, a false narrative was perpetrated by these criminals very quickly and indicated that an unarmed teen was shot and then called for people to come downtown to loot.
Right now, they're protesting first and asking questions later. And all of this is fueling, as you and I have discussed many times, these defunding efforts going on in one city after another, police departments.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, many of the protests were based on falsehoods. For example, the Ferguson narrative, hands up, don't shoot, is false. It's false. Okay? And then what happens is people who know the real facts, they're people who know the truth, then they get blackballed and you can't speak to this, you can't address this. And my contention is that the more you build movements on lies, the more you build movements on false narratives, the moment someone can explode that false narrative, then they can explode the whole movement, even if there's much truth, even if there are real issues. I think we all agree. I would think very, very few Americans would disagree with the notion that there is police brutality, that police sometimes go too far. We'd have very different views of how often that happens, but we'd agree, yeah, difficult job and often taking their own lives in their hands, and we can't relate to what a lot of the dangers and issues that they face and deal with, but certainly you got bad apples and certainly it's police brutality. So we all agree, let's deal with that. But then you have the false narrative, you have the hands up, don't shoot, that did not happen, that three separate investigations, two of which were really looking for evidence that happened, none could find that that actually happened, people could then dismiss the whole police brutality narrative. They can dismiss the whole narrative by saying, well, that never happened there. Okay, so let's get rid of the lies. Just like when I do a debate, if I have a choice between giving you five irrefutable points and 5 points that are strong, so 10 points total, it's wiser that I just major on the five irrefutable ones. Because otherwise, if I've got a skilled debating opponent, what that person will do is they'll just pick the other five off because they're not as they're strong, but they're not as strong. They'll pick those off and therefore make it look like the others don't exist. So let's not give anybody an excuse for dealing with the truth. Let's put truthful narratives out there. Recent riots with Chicago, allegedly shooting for no good reason. Well, it turns out that there was a man who had been arrested 4 times, including endangering a child, shooting at police. They returned fire. He was shot and hospitalized, expected to live. But it was based on false narratives, another police shooting, unjustified, the riots, the looting. Here, can you name for me a more prominent black voice that is associated with the liberal democratic movement that has been widely respected in many circles for many, many years as a civil rights leader? Can you name a voice that would be louder than Jesse Jackson's? All right. Obviously, he has his critics. Okay. And I'm not a fan of his politics. But certainly prominent voice here. Look at what Jesse Jackson tweeted. Jesse Jackson about the riots. He said, this act of pillaging, robbing, and looting in Chicago was humiliating, embarrassing, and morally wrong. It must not be associated with our quest for social justice and equality. Dr. King, Medgar Evers, John Lewis, our martyrs cried together in shame, stop the violence, save the children. All right, now, obviously, word social justice that has a certain meaning and agenda with it. So he's being who he is. But my point is for Reverend Jesse Jackson to say this is embarrassing, this is humiliating, to call it pillaging, he's exactly right. Friends, there is a dangerous spirit, a spirit of anarchy, lawlessness, rebellion. As we've argued, there is a Jezebelic spirit behind much of this. It is destructive, and soon enough, it will turn on you as a follower of Jesus. So let's get on with the matter of justice. Let's get on with the matter of having helpful conversations and learning from each other. Let's get on with the matter of dealing with issues where they exist, and let's do away with this nonsense that looting is reparation. Nonsense.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm not making this up. I looked into these stories. I dug. I found primary source quotes. In other words, out of the horse's mouth, not someone said, not a headline misreporting, not a misleading article, but actual tweets, texts, statements from professors, from university websites that support the idea that math is inherently racist, that grammar is inherently racist. Yeah, proper grammar. For example, you grew up in a certain part of America, the education you received, the way you learned to speak was not in harmony with the way people were learning in most of the rest of the country. So you learned with improper grammar because of your environment. The school system didn't really support you. Now you are able to make it into college. But now in college, you will be penalized for improper grammar, improper word usage, and therefore that is a racist construct. Instead, you should be graded based on your effort, not grammar, if it's an English writing assignment. Math, to say 2 + 2 = 4, is also racist. I've written an article on this. Grammar's racist. Math is racist. And so are you. And again, I address these things because they make a mockery of dealing with real issues of racism. They make a mockery. in looking at any lingering effects from our past history in America. They make a mockery of that, and they allow people to just scorn the whole subject. And when I say math is racist, grammar's racist, so are you. If you dare question it, then that proves you are racist. Oh yeah. Okay. So last month, there was a story, got a lot of circulation. Rutgers University declared grammar to be racist. It was one professor had made certain statements. The professor said she was misunderstood. Fact checkers have challenged that. Different fact checkers have challenged that. So let's step back from that. But February 21st, 2017, the University of Washington produced an anti-racist poster which insists American grammar is racist and an unjust language structure, promising to prioritize rhetoric over grammatical correctness. So if you really say the thing with passion, even if it's grammatically full of error, then you're going to get good English grades for that. As explained on the university's Tacoma-based website, racism is the normal condition of things. Linguistic and writing research has shown clearly for many decades that there is no inherent standard of English. Language is constantly changing. These two facts make it very difficult to justify placing people in hierarchies or restricting opportunities and privileges because of the way people communicate in particular versions of English. So here's the point. English is not standardized across the country. For example, in the South, you could use the expression, I'm fixing to do this. But in New York, if you're fixing, you've got a tool in your hand. You're fixing something. There are expressions that we use. There are words we use. Words then get picked up. Urban vocabulary gets picked up. The word woke got picked up by the mainstream, things like that. So there's no standard. And therefore, to subject people to that standard, now they get into a higher educational setting, that's racist. Because obviously it's the white grammar, the predominant grammar, the elite grammar, that's considered proper English. Now, what's interesting is that statement used proper English. That statement was grammatically correct. That statement used capitalization. That statement put periods where they belonged. That statement used conjunctions and prepositions and nouns and verbs properly. Why? Because there are basic rules. There are basic rules. And if you don't communicate using those basic rules, you will be misunderstood. And if you're in college to learn certain skills to equip you for the workplace, to equip you for a career, then you have to learn to use words properly. That's not racist. You say, but it's unfair because a lot of kids growing up in the inner city don't have good educational opportunities. They've got a few strikes against them. That's a big question. That's a massive question. That's a giant issue. And do we need to make school vouchers possible for them so they can go to other schools? And what can we do together as a country to help address some of these real issues? The whole purpose, though, of education then is to correct the errors and fill in the truth and give right, helpful information. Okay, let's go further. Professor Walter Williams, the Daily Signal, September 11th, 2019, wrote this. Just when we thought colleges could not spout lunar ideas, we have a new one from American University. They hired a professor to teach other professors to grade students based on their labor rather than their writing ability. So the newly hired professor, Asao B. Inoue, who, interestingly enough, also served as a professor at the aforementioned University of Washington in Tacoma, he's the new prof there. Williams noted that Inoue believes that a person's writing ability should not be assessed in order to promote anti-racist objectives. And then we taught American University's faculty members that their previous practices of grading writing promoted white language supremacy. Friends, this is utterly ridiculous. I do understand the issue that is being raised. You know, for example, standardized tests have been used, SATs, PSATs, for decades. And wherever you are in the country, as far as I know, everybody takes the same test. Well, there are kids grew up in the inner city many, many years ago, decades ago, I saw this, and used certain vocabulary certain ways. And when they would get to these tests, they would do really poorly on them. And then, to illustrate the point, kids that grew up, say, white kids in suburbia, they were given a test in language that would be more appropriate for inner city kids, and they bombed on those tests because the vocabulary was so different. I understand the issues. I don't understand them deeply. In other words, I don't work within that children's education field, but I understand the issue. I even understand the point these guys are making. But the you are trying to get some level of uniformity in a culture. There is a reason, for example, where if you are on primetime TV or if you're a sportscaster or something like that, you don't use profanity. All right. And then you may have a live event that's on cable and they use it because it's a different setting and they're allowed to. So it's understood. There are certain protocol. There are methods of communication. I go on further. Yeah. How about a lecture from this professor creating anti-racist writing assessment ecologies in writing courses? Okay, let's move over to math. Let's move over to math. August 9th, 2020, so just a couple days ago, Campus Reform announced that math professors and academics at top universities, including Harvard and the University of Illinois, discussed the Eurocentric roots of American mathematics on Twitter. They asserted that the statement, 2 plus 2 equals 4, is rooted in Western definitions of mathematics. So Ben Zeisloff reports Lori Rubel, who teaches math education at Brooklyn College, says that the idea of math being culturally neutral is a myth, that asking whether 2 plus 2 equals 4 reeks of white supremacist patriarchy. Oh, but of course, obviously. And hey, I was always good at math. Talk about white supremacy, right? Oh, and Jewish white supremacy on top of it. So here's her tweet. Along with the, of course, math is neutral, 2 plus 2 equals 4 trope, are the related and creepy, math is pure, and protect math. So these are quotes. So math is pure, protect math. It's creepy. Reeks of white supremacist patriarchy. Oh, yeah, protect math, reeks of white supremacist patriarchy. She said, I'd rather think on nurturing people and protecting the planet with math in service of them goals. Oh, did she intentionally use poor grammar to prove a point? She added, the idea that math or data is culturally neutral in any way objective is a myth. I'm ready to move on with that understanding. Who's coming with me? I mean, to me, this stuff is as simple as 2 plus 2 equals 4. But, however, that's not racist to even say it. All right, now let's step back from this for a moment. There are arguments that the way data is used and processed in America puts certain people at disadvantage. Could be. That's possible. But that does not, so you look into those issues. I'm always open-minded to look into issues. And when people say there's more going on in the US, I'm open-minded to look into that. But come on, to say that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is not simple, objective truth, to say it reeks of white supremacy, to me that reeks of a social madness, that reeks of a massive educational philosophy of deconstructing truth. And friends, this is what universities have been about for years, and we need more and more universities that teach facts and history and truth. History is taught now, geography is taught. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? And then here, decades ago, there was something called feminist geography. I remember reading about this years ago. So in my article, I talk about it. Feminist geography emerged in the 1970s when members of the women's movement called on academia to include women as both producers and subjects of academic work. Feminist geographers aim to incorporate positions of race, class, ability, and sexuality into study of geography. So how do you do that? You're looking at the topography of Greenland, or the size of Iceland, or the borders of Mexico, and the how will you incorporate positions of race, class, ability, and sexuality into study of geography? So the Wikipedia article says, the discipline has been subject to several controversies. So instead of the so-called three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, today the three R's would rather be described as revisionist, radical, and ridiculous. It's as simple as A, B, C. There you have it. Call me what names you want. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends, we're going to have an edifying, encouraging conversation, one that will really glorify the Lord, one that will bless you, one that will strengthen you. Over the years, I've had the great joy of getting to know Tom Gilson. He has been involved in campus ministry. He has been a Christian strategist and thinker. He's now a senior editor with The Stream, where I normally write about five articles a week. He's the author or editor of six books. We're going to talk about his most recent book. The thing I've always appreciated about Tom is there is a Christ-like security and compassion in him, by which I mean whatever you throw his way, objection, problem, issue, there's a security with which he hears it and a caring about people first response. In other words, it's not about winning an argument. It's about helping people. So Tom's newest book, Too Good to Be False, How Jesus's Incomparable Character Reveals His Reality. Tom, welcome back to The Line of Fire. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Good to be here.
So Tom, before we dig into your new book, let's just talk about the importance of having answers for difficult questions people are asking. We're hearing about Christian leaders falling away from the faith, and many of them give reasons like the problem of evil or the church's stance on homosexuality. Many kids don't believe what their parents believed. Why do you think it's essential that the church provide solid answers for these type of questions?
Well, there's eternal implications. That's the biggest reason. Well, let me tell the story of my son. Since you brought it up, something like that. Our youth pastor was sent to prison when my son was a senior in high school for sexual misbehavior. A couple of years later, I asked my son, "Why do you still believe?" And he said, "Because the things he taught are still true." He knew he had reasons to believe. Of course, he was raised with an apologist in the home as a dad. He knew that it was still true, and he didn't fall away. And it is still true, even if people make mistakes, even big ones.
So the truth was secure enough, deep enough in his heart. He knew it wasn't just, I had an experience, and I got to kind of shut my mind off, that you had talked with your son about the issues over the years. And you've written articles about this. You're going through major questions that come up. You've written a book that I endorse with questions that kids ask about homosexuality and having these conversations. So you must, on a regular basis, hear from people that are struggling, or my son no longer believes, or my daughter doesn't believe, or what do I tell my kid in college? You must run into this all the time.
Yeah, it's mostly online because, like a lot of Christians, most of my personal relationships are with other Christians, but it is also with Christians. Marriage is falling apart. And, there's a lot of pain in people's lives. And part of the point of Too Good to Be False is that it's Jesus no matter what. In other words, he's still good enough. He's still the truth. He's still worth following. There's all kinds of pain, but he's there for it. Take heart. He said, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world.
All right, so let's get to your newest book. And I know you were really excited about it, and you've got some amazing endorsements about it. So what's the thesis of it? It's a fascinating title. What's the thesis?
Yeah, the thesis is that Jesus is too good to be false. I've had people, even, including some good Christian apologists, say, when I picked up the book, I was skeptical. I'm pretty sure you can't make that case work. And they've read it, and they said, okay, it works. So the first thing you want to do is not jump to the conclusion that it's something that you've heard before. This hasn't been published in 90 years or more, this way of looking at Jesus. And it splits it into two plus a third part. The first part is how incredibly, astonishingly amazing Jesus is. I had to tell my typewriter not to write more superlatives, my keyboard. And then the second part is that he is so good that the skeptic's explanation for where the story came from doesn't fit the story. It can't be, their explanation can't be the right explanation for how we got our Gospels. And so the other explanation is, it's true. And it's not legend, it's true.
All right, so we're going to dig into that and think through issues with skeptics. By the way, if you would consider yourself a skeptic or find what Tom is saying to be hard to believe, somewhat incredible, well, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I may take some calls before the we get to the top of the hour. But I remember many years ago reading Charles Spurgeon, and he was talking about the character of different people in the Bible. And you think of Peter, and you can describe his character. Paul, you can describe him. Jeremiah, you can describe him. Moses, you can describe him, based on what we know. But Jesus transcended any one category. That to try to describe him as one way or leaning this way was completely missing the larger point. So paint a picture for us. Most people listening now are believers, but I don't think we fully appreciate who Jesus really is. So go ahead with some of the superlatives. Paint a picture of this amazing Savior.
Yeah. Boy, there's so many, and that's why I took a book. But the first one that I realized in the first substantive chapter in the book is about Jesus' astonishing love. And I start by imagining what it would be like to have incredible power. And what would you do if you were suddenly granted incredible power? Maybe someone gave you $1 billion and you had all this economic power. Maybe you got bitten by a radioactive ant or something. And you had this incredible ability to do things no one else could do. Jesus had incredible power even beyond those imaginings. If I were the best person in history, bar one, and I got $1 billion and I was giving it all to missions and feeding the poor and stopping sex trafficking and everything else like that, I think, I might still get the roof repaired. I might still take my family out on a vacation.
Yep.
What Jesus did was he had this unbelievable power, which, by the way, always corrupts. Always corrupts when you have that much power to some degree. And he didn't even turn a stone into a piece of bread when he was hungry. He used his power only for others.
Mm.
And I can't imagine being that good. It actually scares me to think that I would do everything for the good of others the way he did. I look at that. And I fall to my face and I go, God, you are beyond me. And God fits Jesus. I mean, this is where worship actually flows, not just from the head, but from the heart, is when you realize how much better he is than you realized. That's one. There's lots of them.
Yeah, and just as you're throwing that out, the question is, how often did most of us really think about that? Probably never, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's just one part of one chapter in your book. So you start off seeing Jesus through new eyes, and then part one, greater than you know. And this is then divided into Jesus's astonishing love, his surpassing brilliance, his authority, his paradoxical leadership, his world-changing mission, the man who was God, Jesus' friend. So let's talk about his paradoxical leadership. What's so extraordinary about that?
Yeah, there are leadership books written about Jesus. I haven't read them all, but I don't think they get what's really weird about Jesus as a leader. His leadership in human terms, and I've got a master's in organizational psych, I know this, his leadership in human terms never should have worked. But it did. So something else is going on to make it work. Here's what I mean is you don't, can you imagine following a leader who's always right, who never learns from a mistake, who never wants your opinion unless he wants to explain how you're wrong, who never learns from experience, who it's his way or the highway? This is a picture of a horrible person to work with. And yet people followed him gladly. And so you have to look into what was it about Jesus that made people want to follow him when they would never follow another human leader with those traits. He did have the authority. He wasn't ever wrong. He didn't learn from his mistakes because he didn't make any. And somehow his incredible, overwhelming love must have gotten through to them. So these things, it takes something very unusual to make up for what would normally in the literature be called horrible leadership deficits. Because, by the way, he started a movement that's still going 2,000 years and billions of people later. That's not a bad leadership track record.
And people are willing to die for him.
Yeah.
The book, Too Good to Be False, How Jesus' Incomparable Character Reveals His Reality, right now the number one new release in Christian apologetics on Amazon, and the endorsers, it's like a who's who list of senior apologists, Josh McDowell, Lee Strobel, J.P. Moreland, Eric Metaxas. Josh McDowell says this book takes a fresh look at the uniquely great character of Jesus and finds in his greatness a new and compelling case for the truth of his story and present it in the Gospels. We've got a minute before the break. How did writing this book affect you?
It brought me into touch with Jesus like never before, and I am worshiping him and in love with him like I have never been. It's making me easier to walk with him. It's enlivening my prayer life. And I just love telling his story. It's made it more fun to tell his story.
Yeah, it's when you focus on him, gaze on him. Isaac Ambrose wrote a 700-page book called Looking Unto Jesus that Leonard Ravenhill used to recommend to preachers. He said the whole book is on those three words from Hebrews 12, looking unto Jesus. But it is that extraordinary thing that gazing on him, really understanding. When I wrote a book recently that focused on the resurrection, I was blown away even more by the reality of the resurrection, having focused on it. All right, we'll be back with Tom Gilson. I want to take up the question of the Skeptic's Challenge and how this has responded to the new book, Too Good to Be False. Fascinating title. How Jesus' incomparable character reveals his reality. Yeah, last part of the book, part three, Jesus No Matter What, epilogue for pastors, teachers, other ministers, study guide, practical, as always, with Tom. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with my friend and colleague, Tom Gilson. You can read him regularly at the stream, stream.org. Practical, excellent, edifying, insightful articles. His new book, Too Good to Be False, looking at the character of Jesus. So, Tom, obviously, many skeptics who question the veracity of what's written in the Gospels, the dependability of it. These are just later myths, like the so-called apocryphal Gospels, and you have an appendix dealing with that. But how do the gospel accounts demonstrate the truth of the gospel accounts? Isn't that kind of using circular reason to prove what you've already assumed? These are inspired writings and they paint an inspired picture and therefore they're inspired. So what's the critic's argument? How do you respond to it?
Yeah, it's not circular reasoning because I do go outside that for other information to draw in. And what it is the skeptics will tell you that, and we all agree, by the way, it's a story, and I think everyone agrees that stories come from somewhere. And you need to have some explanation for for a story like this would come from, because it is an unusual story, and people are following it. Where did this story come from? Well, this is where we add some new information. Skeptics, generally speaking, and there's variations on this, but skeptics, generally speaking, will tell you that the story started when the disciples were disappointed, because there really was a Jesus, and he had a following, but they were just devastated when he died. And they'd invested so much in him that And this happens in psychology. They deal with it under cognitive dissonance theory. Yep. They had to find a way to make it true. And so they did. They invented a resurrection so he could still be their Messiah. So it got off to a shaky start with something that would normally we would call just kind of crazy. And then from there, what you'll hear, Bart Ehrman talks in, I think, 4 books about what he calls the telephone game, where the story spread around everywhere, Europe, Asia Minor, North Africa, and the Israel region. And as it went, it changed oral tradition from one mouth to the next. It just kept changing. And that's what he says. What happens when stories do that? They change. And so he thinks that that explains things like maybe how many, the discrepancy or apparent discrepancy in how many angels there were at the tomb and so on. It changed and it developed and it morphed into the God story that we have. So that's a typical skeptical explanation for where the Gospels came from. The problem is that a backstory has to fit the story. In the book, I talk about the novel about concert pianist, where a living concert pianist explains that this novel is so true to what it's like, everything from being on the road to feeling the music flow out from your fingers. Well, you open up the book, you look at the fly leaf, and it says it was written by a pro hockey player from Calgary and his business manager. You go, nah, something doesn't fit here. The backstory has to fit. Well, the skeptic's backstory, as I look at that, Bart Ehrman says stories change. That's way too weak a word for it. They get distorted. They get corrupted. They get scrambled when they go through that kind of multicultural, multi-language, multi-everything kind of telephone game. And then they all somehow circulated back, and they landed in 4 places, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, interdependent, but 4 different places. And they all landed on one character, Jesus, who is decidedly not scrambled.
Mm-hmm.
He is perfect in multiple discernible, objectively describable aspects of his character. And it's the same Jesus, all 4 landing points. The backstory, the story scrambling backstory, doesn't explain Jesus because he is perfectly integrated, one person, and unique. There were no other Jews like him. No one else like him. How did it land there if it was scrambled along the way? I don't think that the skeptic story explains how we got the Gospels. And the only other live option on the table right now is that the Gospels are true reportage of a man who really lived.
Right. So when you think through the critical theories, when you give credence to them and then try to put things together, you don't end up with just Jesus. You don't end up with this personage. And especially when people will point to alleged discrepancies between them that would indicate at the least that they didn't all sit together in the same room and say, let's make sure that we tell this all exactly the same way, because we can see the individuality in them. And yet what emerges is the kind of thing, like some famous astrophysicist once said that the idea of just creation just happening on its own, the Big Bang on its own, is just like a hurricane sweeps through a junkyard, you end up with a Boeing 747. It's the same kind of thing, except in a literary way. What about, you have an appendix on this, the apocryphal Gospels. Aren't there other Gospels that are just as early that tell different stories about Jesus?
No, they're not just as early. The 4 Gospels in the canon, they're all certainly first century, and there's some discussion as to what point in the first century, but the apocryphal Gospels are all at least later than 100 AD, and many of them much later. The other thing, too, is you can look at them and you go, okay, that's not the same Jesus.
Yep.
It just isn't the same Jesus, and it's almost interesting to look at them and say, okay, that doesn't look like Jesus, and you go back and look at the 4, you go, he really is the same character all the way through. He exhibits the same character all the way through. and it becomes even more clear by the comparison.
Yeah, and again, when you read some of the apocryphal accounts, it's one of the first things that happens. You think, where'd they get this from? The Jesus of the Quran is a very different Jesus, and that's because some of Muhammad's influencers and teachers got stuff from other material, later material, and then there's no evidence that these apocryphal gospels were ever widely accepted in the early church or put together in collections with the synoptic gospels in regular canonical collections and things like that. So again, it's just one of these things that's raised, but when you dig deeper, it falls apart. Tom, last question. What are you hoping that the readers will get out of this, pastors, leaders, just interested Christian readers? What are you hoping they'll get out of this book?
For one thing, I hope readers do it in community. There's a discussion guide in the back for people to do it in small groups. It's a fun read, actually. Gary Habermas said it this way. I hope they enjoy reading it, but I hope they really get a picture of how great Jesus is and how greatly we can trust in the truth of his story. So that, by the way, when the pressure comes, this is part three of the book, when the pressure comes, they can say, I'm still following Jesus no matter what.
Yeah, and Tom, you know my story, coming to faith as a young Jewish man, challenged by the rabbis, challenged by professors. You kind of get thrown in the deep water and have to learn how to swim. But the more you ask the hard questions, which God doesn't mind, the more you find solid answers. And we both had the same experience. The unexpected deepening and confirming of faith when we're examining difficult, critical issues, that the deeper you dig, the more solid the foundation you find. Friends, you can order the book on Amazon. You get the ebook or the paperback. Tom Gilson, Gilson, Too Good to Be False. And you could read Tom's articles every single week over at the stream.org. Hey, Tom, keep up the great work, and may the Lord bless the circulation of this book.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for this conversation. I enjoyed it, Michael.
You bet. Absolutely. Yeah. I remember being at some meetings with Tom, some strategy meetings and things like that. And what I always appreciated was that heart for, okay, let's be practical here. Let's think this through. Let's look at a strategy that's actually going to help people. And then let's welcome the hard questions. Friends, a lot of people are losing their faith these days because the church is not creating an environment where they feel comfortable asking the hard questions. Or if they do, we're not providing the solid answers for them. And look, Christian apologetics are very strong today. There are many, many fine teachers from scientific subjects to theological subjects to philosophical subjects to subjects dealing with different religions and so on. There's a lot of material, and a lot of it's available for free. Yeah, listen, I write books. I pour into a book so you'll get the book and get everything I can pour into in that form. But there's a ton of stuff that's available freely. You can watch on YouTube. You can go to various websites of various apologists. You can read the information. You can watch teaching videos. Then you can buy the books to go deeper or take whole courses. The information is available. Let's create an environment where people feel free, feel secure enough to be able to ask difficult questions, challenging questions. And if we don't have the answer, our response is, that's a great question. Nobody ever asked me that before. Let's dig in. Let's find answers together. Let's do that. I was just talking to a Jewish man yesterday struggling with his faith, and I said, hey, man, we'll get you strong, but not by sticking our head in the sand. Not at all. Rather, we'll get you strong by looking at the truth. And friends, we got plenty of truth on our website. Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Visit us there. Take advantage of the boatloads, literally thousands of hours of free material, resources for you at AskDrBrown.org. Back with you tomorrow. Shake the name.